Hello, this is Jennifer Williams, Program Manager at the Scottish Poetry Library, and every once in a while I have to pinch myself because I realize that I am so lucky to have such an amazing job. And this year at the Stanza Poetry Festival was one of those times because I had the chance to interview one of my favorite poets in the whole world, a poet that was deeply inspiring to me at a very important time in my life, when my dear uncle brought me to a bookshop in Morristown, New Jersey, and the book The Descent of Alette seemed to fall off the shelf and into my hand. And that beautiful book by the poet Alice Notley has been with me ever since. So when Eleanor, the director of Stanza, asked if I would like to be in conversation in a roundtable event with Alice, I pretty much did a few backflips and then said, yes, yes, I would love that. So we've made a recording of that in partnership with Stanza, and I'm really delighted to be able to share that with you now. I hope you enjoy it as much as I enjoyed having a chance to spend some time with Alice Notley.
You're listening to a Scottish Poetry Library podcast.
Alice has produced over 35 books in her writing career, including works of autobiography and literary essays, as well as poetry. Her most recent book is Negativity's Kiss, which came out last year with the University Presses of Rouen and L'Arve in France. She's specialised in recent years in book-length, epic, and sometimes narrative autobiographical works, saying in the postface to Negativity's Kiss, "My books are the embodiment of everything I am and think. They are my accomplishment and identity." She also has two books forthcoming in America this year. J.L. Williams, with whom Alice will be in conversation, is also a poet. Her most recent book is Locust and Marlin, which came out from Shearsman, and she's also a very energetic collaborator with musicians, sonic artists, and 45-minute conversation here. Thank you very much for joining me in welcoming to Stanza Alice Notley and J.L. Williams.
Thank you so much, Tom, and thank you all for being here. It's a great pleasure. I'll just say a few words about how we discussed this event might go. I'm not sure if anyone was here for Alice's brilliant reading on the center stage a couple evenings ago, but her reading is so fabulous. I thought it'd be a shame to not have some of that featured here as well. So I've asked her if she might kick everything off with a little reading, then we'll talk a bit. Hopefully I have time to take a couple questions from you and then finish off with another reading. So we'll see if we can fit all that in. I have enough questions here to talk for about 2 days, so I'll try not to run over too long. Just wanted to mention, as well, as you probably know, I also work as the program manager at the Poetry Library, and for them and for Eleanor, I said we'd record this event with Alice's permission. So just so you know, if you do speak, it's being recorded. We'll use it for a podcast. But if you say something that you think, I cannot reveal that to the public, it's all right. Just let me know. We'll edit it out. So without further ado, I'd love to invite Alice.
How long should I read?
Well,
5 minutes?
Yeah, I think if we just start with a few minutes and then we can talk, and if you want to bring...
You wanted me to read a little bit from The Descent of Alette.
Oh, that was
what I'll read a poem from The Descent of Alette, and I'll read something I didn't read the other night.
Okay.
Negativity's Kiss, but I have to find it.
I'll just say while you're doing that.
This is very improvisatory.
Descent of Alette. This is actually my copy that I got. It must have been it just when it was published, because it would have been about, this was published in 96 or 97. In New Jersey, my uncle took me to this wonderful bookshop and sort of reached up and it leapt into my hand off the shelf. And so this is my well-thumbed, well-worn copy that has come with me everywhere since then. And it's been such a sort of comfort and an inspiration to me all these years. So I just got Alice to sign it for me the other day, which was a great treat.
The pages have turned this very interesting brown color.
Yeah, they're sort of beautiful color now.
Okay, here's a page from The Descent of Alette. A car awash with blood, blood at our feet, and I and others, have small springs of blood from our feet and knees. There is an inch or two of blood all over the car floor, replenished periodically by our body springs of blood and trickling out the door when it opens at stations. The tyrant sends a hologram, a life-size hologram of himself into our car. He stands mid-car and says, "The blood at our feet has cost me so much. The blood at our feet has cost us so much. To clean the blood is difficult to clean the car. There is a litter of things in the wash of blood. I see sanitary pads, Kleenex, black blood encrusted, old bandages. An old black suitcase spills out, torn men's clothes and frayed towels. The hologram tyrant says, 'Here are my tears,' holds up his palm. His tears are small drops of jade, red and white jade. His tears have turned to jade. They will be placed in a national museum. There is something in my ear. I pull it out, a white cord, a long silk cord. I pull it out and hear our blood. It hums, a unison one, note loud, a sheet of sound. It hangs there, sad insect noise, insect-like, our blood." And here's a page from something more recent. This is a character speaking. "My only value is poetry. Listen up, street. What comes from mouth and wrist ill-reputed, reputed, oh, you know, the stupid voice says. It can't replace religion, and it isn't as big as painting, and it doesn't speak to our sacred street like music. And who can read it? It isn't a novel. And what can it say, precious or corny like bad prose, or it's abstract so five guys can gloat? What do you think you've made of it? Of course it doesn't care what you think or how small-minded its own practitioners become. It screams through my mouth in syllables of trespass, assassination, and faithlessness like a diamond can cut you on approach. Hates your propositions. Fuck you. I'm beautiful and unattainable. Flame keeper, you have a mind like a pandering rat's. So if it isn't human worth, what is it? And since you want to define it so you can ply your craft, broadly, it's anything, anything. I say it is. You have no idea. An idea, a glass. Poetry, that illegality, fills it with poisons you're afraid of, have never drunk. You've tried to accumulate millionaire memories. I deny memory, you say. I live in the present. Special. Box of billet-doux and testaments to precisely you. Didn't even try to make a world of love. I work from the absent district under the black rainbow sign. I spew death words on your classes, academic and social."
Fantastic. As I'm sure you can all feel and see this, I feel like you channel this really amazing energy when you read. Do you enjoy reading it?
Oh, I love to read, and I change, and I go away to another place, and it's hard to come back. I did notice that the measure of the first one invaded the second one in the middle, and then I had to remember what the rhythms of this book were like as opposed to the rhythms of that book, and that was strange.
Because we were talking yesterday about Alette is entirely written with this use of these quotation marks every few words that break up each poem into a few little fragments, and it has a very strong rhythmic effect on those.
Their
poems.
Feet, their poetic feet.
yeah. It's something I was actually reading some essays this morning written about you, but about this idea of always exploring new forms and being open to new forms. And I feel like in your career over time, it doesn't feel like you've felt tied to anyone. You've found the form that suits each book.
Well, it feels as if I have to invent a new form for each book. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the process. And I occasionally do use old forms, but I do it secretly, and I tend not to tell people what I'm doing or where it comes from or how I did it. For example, recently I've been using Horace's meters, but I do it in a way I mean, you obviously can't do that in English, and there's been a discussion of how you can't do that in English for several hundred years. So I don't want to be part of that discussion because I know I can't do that. I know I can't do a meter where a vowel is emphasized in a certain way because you can't do that in English. But what I can do is stare at the meters at the back of the Low Classics and somehow impress them into my mind and make something which retroactively was predicted by these. These are like Latin meters, actually, but I got it from William Carlos Williams a bit in his variable foot. Mm-hmm. It's the sense that a line is divided into these feet, but they're not necessarily two, three syllable feet. They're these long feet, and they're different from each other, and you never quite know what's going to come up, but it makes for a very long line, as many as 16 syllables, and this is probably too technical.
Oh, no. That's interesting.
This is the kind of thought process I have, and it's not necessarily lucid, and then somehow it turns into these lines.
Mm-hmm.
It turns into a sound, and it turns into a live thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's all alive.
And you're very interested in telling stories, aren't you? Or it feels like they're...
I started out as a story writer. I went to Iowa as a story writer. I'm from this very small town in the Mojave Desert, and I only knew that there were novelists and story writers. There were fiction writers. And I knew there were poets, but they were all dead. But I went to university in New York City. I went to Barnard College, which is a very sophisticated college. And I sort of found that there were live poets. But nonetheless, as a writer, I was writing stories. And it didn't occur to me that I was writing them the way poets write poems, because I didn't know how poets write poems. But I was writing these stories word by word. And it was agony. Getting each word out, and I wrote some pretty good stories, but not very many. And I was accepted at the University of Iowa in the fiction workshop, and I went there as a fiction writer. And then I met poets, and I turned into a poet. And I did my degree in fiction and poetry.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if anyone else did that,
mm-hmm.
but that's what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought I probably couldn't tell stories. That I wasn't a very good storyteller. I knew I couldn't tell jokes, but I could only remember the punchline.
But there are full of funny bits.
Well, there's a difference between jokes and wit, but nobody explained that to me. But what happened was that the story gradually came back into the poems,
mm-hmm.
and I was telling stories as I was writing poems. And so it really did make sense that I started out as a fiction writer. And my poems became more and more fictional. And I realized that the kind of poetry I liked was the long narrative poem. I liked Chaucer, and I liked Dante. Right? And I liked Shakespeare a lot, and you know, story, people talking, all of that.
And
plus the meter.
Yes.
But where is it exactly? You know?
Mm.
It's hidden. It's supposed to be.
Mm. But also I think, you know, it's part of what's so exciting for me, I think, when you're hearing it, is that you're getting those stories, but in what feels like a much more direct and linguistically interesting way than you might get them in a novel. All the crap is pulled out.
Yeah. Novels are very flat.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to write one myself.
No, and I think that's interesting, is this sense of your work being multi-dimensional and polyphonic, and having, as reading that you'd spoken about this idea of, in one piece that you're working on, of your head as a kind of Byzantine church, and all the icons and murals in there, being able to conjure the crystalline city which sits over the real city. But these lenses, I think, are something so interesting in your work, the difference between the real world and how we perceive the world.
That was I was writing that book, which is called Reason and Other Women, in the 90s, and it was the only time where I ever applied for a Guggenheim, and I kept trying to explain. You're supposed to talk about what your project is. And I kept trying to explain to them that I was working on this project that involved my head being a Byzantine church, and I knew that I was never going to get a Guggenheim, and I would just do it. I did it every year for about 3 years, and then I gave up, and I've never applied since then, because I can't explain what I'm doing, and I don't think I should have to.
Oh, see, I would have given you the Guggenheim. That was a great explanation.
But the idea was that my head was... I fell in love with Byzantine art at the same time as I wanted to write very fast on the typewriter and try to figure out how the mind worked. And I wanted to... none of this project fit together, and none of my projects ever do fit together. They're always made of... there are always three or four different directions that don't quite mesh. Because I was also reading Christine de Pizan and being very affected by the La Cité des Dames, and that's a different historical period from the Byzantine period. I was looking at these pictures and books of Byzantine icons and writing as fast as I could, and all the words all turned into dots of a mosaic, and it was as if the mosaics I was looking at in the books became the words I was writing down. And all of this was very complex, and nobody really likes to read the book, but I love the book.
Mm-hmm.
The book is wonderful. And I kept trying to get it published, and none of my publishers would publish it. And I finally found a guy, Charles Alexander Chax, and he Chax Press, and he published it. It was turned down by 7 publishers, and I was already fairly well known, and it would just get turned down.
I was wondering that you, I imagine this, we were talking about at the beginning, if we had Alice's complete poems, this book would take up a sort of Borghesian wall, you know, it would be an enormous book, and you've been so productive, and you write, it sounds like you write most days, you read every day. To produce that much work, do you find it comes quite naturally out of you, and then it sounds like it's not always easy to get it published as well. Has publishing been a struggle, or?
I suppose everything's a struggle and nothing is at the same time. It's, you know, it's what you do. Mostly I write. I write every day, except when I'm traveling. I write in the morning, same time of day, every day, on the same chair, and I'm always writing something different, but I keep the routine consistent, and then I amass these piles of manuscripts, and then I have to try to figure out how to get them published, because there, at a certain point, I look and there are too many of them, and I've got to get rid of some of them, and then I try to see what to do, and one of my publishers is Penguin USA. They're probably my best publisher, but they only publish a book every 4 years or so. They don't take care of me, and I have discussions with them about whether or not it's okay to go to these other people, and my editor actually tries to think of other publishers for me, and he's very good this way. And I've done a couple of books with Wesleyan, and I maintain a relationship with the small press world, and I publish books with small presses. I publish with whoever will have me, basically. You know, it's...
And do you feel, when you send the work out into the world in that way, does that feel like a loss? Or does that feel like
no.
The poems are free
no.
now? They're
no.
living their life?
No, it kind of doesn't feel like anything. it's not the important part.
Mm, yeah.
I mean, it is important, because you have to make it be concrete. But I don't know. Sometimes I just don't care if the work gets published, and sometimes it seems desperately important because I have so much to tell people. It feels like, but does one? I don't know.
There was a line in one of the poems you read the other night, I believe, I am your mouth, which I thought was fabulous, and it was making me think about that sense of, that may have been a character speaking rather than you, but...
No, that's me. I mean, it was a character, but that's me.
Mm.
That's me.
And that...
Oh, no, that's in the beginning of I Went Down There.
Mm.
I had been to visit my mother, and she had broken her hip. She was 88 or 89 at the time, and then she just got back up. You know, she got her hip fixed, and she lived for another 4 or 5 years, and she had this immense energy to live. I felt very inspired by her, and I came back to my house, and there's no connection here, because there never is, but it felt to me that there were all these spirits under the bed that wanted me to speak for them. And something about the way she had been gave me the courage to write this kind of poetry. And so I felt as if all of these people did want me to talk for them. I have felt this for some years now, and I became their mouth. I'm the mouth of others. I have nothing to say personally.
Mm.
I really don't have that. But on the other hand, the world has a lot to say, and everyone is speaking all the time. And if I can speak for others, then that's probably what I'm supposed to be doing, and that's probably why I learned how to write in a lot of different ways, so that I can speak for a lot of different people.
I feel like there's some sense of you writing from dreams as well sometimes. Is that part of where you find inspiration?
Yes, I always have. I consider sleeping to be part of my work time. But from the time I was a little girl, I've always woken up 3 or 4 times a night, and I wake up and think about what's going on while I'm asleep, and then I go back to sleep, and I think about my dreams and kind of process them and go back to sleep, and it's as if I'm in a state of communication with the world as dreamers. But a lot of the world isn't dreaming at the same time as I'm dreaming, but it's like I'm getting information, and so I watch over my sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Work on it.
I've just started keeping a sort of dream, you know, writing down my dreams in the morning, and I didn't think I was someone who remembered my dreams. And then the minute I started writing it down, now every night I remember my dreams. It's like I've woken up to them. It's quite an exciting feeling to find all this other
There's
stuff
a lot of
happening.
Material there.
Yeah.
And dreams are like important experiences that you have, and they can be, and they can be. A dream can be just as important as an experience as something that happens to you in your life, in your living life, your awake life. It's you know, dreams are of great importance, and in the poem I read, that's a different poem. The tears have turned to jade. That part was from a dream, and I had had it several years previously. I had had it before, way before I wrote that page, but it had stayed with me for a long time. It was about how certain people, if you are a famous person, if you're a general, if you are, if someone has said you're a great writer, then whatever you do is considered to be art. That was the interpretation of the dream. And it goes into the museum. The museum belongs to the elite people, and the judgment of who gets to be in the museum is an elite judgment. And it was about, I think it was about the tears of Eisenhower.
Mm-hmm.
It was the tears of Eisenhower. They had turned to jade, you know, because he was a great general. So
mm-hmm.
his tears were very important. They were artifacts. Whereas we, the people in the subway, who are simply riding the subway, don't get to have our tears placed in the museum.
There was another line from one of your poems the other night. It was something to the effect of, why do we dream? To remember we both exist outside space and time.
We exist outside of space and time.
I thought that was just so...
There's no explanation for dreams. scientific explanations are just pathetic. Nobody knows how to talk about it, or what it is, or where it happens, or why you could dream about someone you've never met, and they could be a fully fleshed person with very clear cut features and clothes and that sort of thing.
And there's another line I love from the Honey poem. What is that one called?
It's called Victorious.
Victorious. It's a spectacular poem.
It's a Victorian title. Victorious.
The language is finding its nearly unfashioned form, which I thought was a kind of wonderful way actually of thinking about a lot of.
I think that's quite
cool. Oh, is it wrong?
Yeah, I can't remember what it is. I could find it.
Mm. Oh, well, maybe I've got it wrong.
It's almost right. It might be right.
but something about that idea again of the poem sort of coming into being in response to the material or these voices that you're trying to convey.
Well, it writes itself, but it wouldn't write itself if you hadn't put a tremendous amount of work previously into learning how to be the person who can write the poem that writes itself. So, I mean, it takes 20 or 30 years to be in that position.
Mm.
And you have to keep reminding you have to know that eventually this will happen to you. It requires a great deal of faith.
We talked a little bit yesterday about you having to change at certain times because of things that had happened in your life that maybe the form you were writing in, that a certain grief or loss or thing had happened, and then you had to find a new way of writing.
The first time it happened was when I had babies.
Mm-hmm.
I had to invent forms. I had to invent forms that would enable me to write with small children around me. I had to invent forms to be able to discuss pregnancy. Then I had an enormous postpartum depression, and somehow I had to incorporate that into my writing. And so I was in a state of formal invention all the time because of these things happening to me. And I learned these accretive forms where I would write bit by bit every day. And I wrote down what my children said and did, and what my husband said and did. And our house was always full of people, and I just started incorporating everything they said into what I wrote. And because I had no time to myself, so I wrote while people were there. I learned how to memorize conversations between people and then write them down later, verbatim. All of these things. And I had no one who had come before me had written about having small children. It was quite daunting, but it was really interesting to be in this position where it felt as if I was doing the first writing like this.
Mm-hmm.
It was scary, but it was also really, really fantastic. And it kind of balanced the fact that I felt so desperate because I was so depressed.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very complicated situation. And then I was a member, supposedly, of the second generation of New York School, the New York School is a very brilliant school of poetry. Probably the best poetry athletes in the United States were in that first generation of the New York School. I mean, it's just fabulous writing. None better than that done by people like Frank O'Hara and John Ashbery. And then we were Kenneth Koch and Jimmy Skylar, and we were the second generation, and we were kind of more working class, and some of us were women, and it was a different kind of generation, but the values were wit, wordplay, brilliant surface of language, things like that, usually keeping it rather light. And then at a certain point, everyone in my life started to die. My husband died, my stepdaughter died, my brother died, my best friend died. And the style just didn't serve me anymore. I couldn't do the style, the self I was at that point couldn't do it. And so I changed styles, and I started writing. I started writing the work that led to this book, and I wrote this book. And my friends disapproved. I had to go against my friendships at that point. Nobody liked The Descent of Alette. Actually, a couple people did. But people that weren't in my school were the ones who liked it. And people would come up to me and tell me not to do this. And Joe Brainerd didn't like it. He really didn't like the quotation marks. And Eileen Miles didn't like the quotation marks. And everybody talked about it. Everybody talked to each other in a certain way. And if you didn't approve of what someone was doing, you told them. It was all very existential and very important, and you had to tell each other things, and so people were always telling me what they didn't like that I was doing.
And how did you find the strength to continue doing what you believed in?
Well, I just knew that I was right. I've always known I was right.
I
thought they were fools.
It's a good thing to remember about your critics. I love it. At this point, if we probably don't have time for too many, but if we just have a couple...
Oh, God, I forgot there was a time limit.
Well, you know, we can be a little flexible about them. A couple of excellent questions from the audience. We'd be happy to take them. Does anyone have any burning questions? Ian?
There was something you said earlier that really struck me, where you were talking about... you learned to write in different styles so that you could speak for different people.
Yes.
And I wondered, because it sounds like some of the way that you think is tied into this sort of union, subconscious, and dream and connectedness of people. Is that, do you feel there's some sort of healing process that you're facilitating by being able to voice things, even if people aren't having, never
yes,
know that you're doing
I do.
It?
I
yeah.
Do.
I
do, but
yeah.
It sounds corny if you say Jungian, you feel terrible.
No,
I don't think about Jung or anything. No, I do think that that's happening, and that is what I'm doing. And that there are voices that come from other places besides this tiny local planet. And, you know, we're all making the universe together over time.
Yeah, that's not corny, it's cool.
Yeah, I just want to say also I absolutely love The Descent of Alette. And I heard you had trouble publishing that at first, did you, or was that?
Well, I didn't have so much trouble publishing it as I did certain other books. I couldn't publish it right away. I was married to Douglas Oliver. He and I were doing a magazine together called Scarlet. And we got the idea together of doing a medieval-type compendium of books that would be our manuscripts we couldn't publish. And in this book was The Descent of Alette and a couple of other sequences of mine. And he put in his book Penniless Politics, which was later published by Blood Axe. And this was before I was published by Penguin. And it's about this big. It's full of different manuscripts of by the two of us. And it's like one of those books that would have, some poetry and an herbal, and you know how the medievals would do that? We were thinking that way. And a novel of Doug's was published in the book. I can't remember what I put in now besides The Descent of Alette.
So did you essentially self-publish that?
We self-published it, and then I sent it to this guy at Penguin. But what made the difference was I sent it to the guy at Penguin, and he didn't get it. And then I sent it to him later. I sent him The Descent of Alette, and I included the explanation at the beginning of how to read it and what the quotation marks were, and then he got it. That was all he needed. Mm-hmm. He needed the little hint about what I was doing formally. Mm-hmm. People who work for places like Penguin are people who love books. Everybody I ever met there had long hair and thick glasses. there were people who had wrecked their eyes reading. You know, and you just kind of have to, you have to tell them some little thing, and they get it. You know? They're bright people.
plenty of other questions.
Could I ask what other contemporary or of your American contemporaries, which ones do you feel poetically close to, and also any younger generation poets that you are particularly interested in?
Yeah, I come out of a particular generation. When I was in my 20s, I was friends with Bernadette Mayer and Ann Waldman, and it felt like the three of us were inventing something together, but we didn't know how to say that the way there would be a bunch of guys and they would be a school and they would know it and they would write manifestos and stuff, and Bernadette and Ann and I didn't know it. Ted used to tell us we were a school. And after a while I figured out we were a school, but as I've said somewhere, it felt like we were inventing a voice for a woman poet altogether, and we would pass it around from each other, from one of us to the next one, and then it would come back around again. And we worked something out by being friends. So I feel close to their work, although I haven't been friends with Bernadette for 30 years, but I still feel really close to her work. She's a very good poet.
I'm curious about your experience as a woman writing poetry, and I know we talked about when even this idea of writing about birth and motherhood and that being very groundbreaking, and also that there weren't many women poets writing when you started writing.
Yes.
Since, but that, and if there's a feeling, has that, and this development of a woman's voice or a way that women can write in poetry, and is there a way that has changed over the years, and how do you feel about that now?
Oh, there are a lot of women writing. There are a lot of women publishing. But there's a ghetto effect where women write and publish together, and I think men like that because they can still hold on to all the power. But women don't seem to notice that this is happening, and they aren't making power for themselves by being apart as a group. And I think men and women should be mixing more.
And
I don't like to just read with women, and I don't like to just be in a group of women. I really like men.
It came up in the breakfast talk yesterday, this idea that about gatekeepers and quotas and whether we need all those sorts of things, and the director of the Rotterdam Festival said, we don't need that. Everything's balanced. We know women
yes,
are great.
So that's balanced.
I'm not sure if that's the case here yet.
There are very many women poets at the moment, but as the Vita people in the United States keep proving, they're not getting reviewed and they're not all getting published. It's just that they're there. They're there, and they keep being like series for women and groups for women. I keep reading with women. And it's like it's gone backwards in a way, even though there are more people involved, more women involved.
On a slightly different note, but maybe about this idea of being alone, we were talking about the fact that you moved to Paris first with your husband, but then when he passed away, you stayed in Paris, and there's maybe a sense of you having found that useful for writing, but then it might be a little bit lonely. It's a bit different than the life you were living in New York, where you had this, all those people in your house and this community around you all the time.
Well, that's true. I don't quite know what to say about it. It feels right to me that I should be alone, that I should not be part of a group, and that I should be writing exactly the way that I am, but it is tremendously lonely. And I don't have anything else to say about that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to be in a couple, as they say in France. I don't want to have to... There's a thing you do when you live with someone else where you compromise your opinions all the time in order to be together. You're always compromising, and both of you do this. And I don't want to do it anymore. I just want to have my own thoughts and have them be my own and do as I please and think, particularly I want to think as I please in write whatever I want. I don't want any criticism or feedback. I don't have to have it anymore.
I think that's something I don't mean to be giving you feedback, but it's something I admire in you so much, and I find it very inspiring. And I think sometimes one can feel so this pressure to try to write things that people will be able to make sense of or will think is great, and yet I feel strongly that that's not a good way to write, that one has to write what's coming from deep inside. It feels like you've really managed to do that. It's really exciting.
Well, I write from what comes from outside.
Outside,
yes. Like, that's the only way to the only way to get so many voices in is to be alone. But I learned how to do that from writing in the apartment full of voices.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of the same thing.
Yeah.
But I've always listened to voices and thought about ways to organize them. And I'm quite interested in drama and theater. I've been going to the Comédie Française in Paris. I've been totally turned on by Racine and Molière, and I discovered a new great literature I didn't know anything about, and I'm old now, and I didn't know how great it was. I didn't know how great Racine was. He is so great. I'm so enthusiastic about this poetry, which also resembles something that I've been trying to do forever. So everything is always the same thing, but read Racine.
I think on that note, unless you have any other questions, I'm sure you can speak to Alice after if you like, but maybe we could have some reading to finish up our session.
Let's see. What should I do this? I wanted to read. I thought it might be nice to read a little bit from In the Pines, but which has been, is it there? Do you know Andrew Whiteman, the musician? He's a member of the Indie Group, Broken Social Scene. How do you know the Indie Group, Broken Social Scene? Well, he and his wife, Ariel, who was a member of another indie band, have gone around. He set some of this to music, and there are records and things. They're called Aurora, those people. If you want to look for the music, it's very, yeah. Too long though.
It's all right.
Whose tears can't I bear? The coat's not just jeans, but songs. He cried after his other sister died. The coat's not just jeans, but tears. I have blood or flame on me, so I can change all writing with a red-hued jaguar cat along, blood in my eyes. You have not to know until it's done. You have not to know. No, I want to know now. She has a high-pitched hypnotic voice. She's with a reddish jaguar cat. She's dyed my hair to match it. This is a folk procedure, too. Whose tears are calling now? I can hear the tribes moaning. Placed by who? Within your spine, your brain, your eyes. Whose tears are songs? Whose moan? Placed within me. Can I take you across? My hair is reddish with blood. She has the voice of hypnos. The blood or flame in my hair and eyes. I've gone with a jaguar in the blood-red coat through the soul-hell transformation. In that old dance hall where only neurons or songs or tears float, someone is chanting in order to cross over. As I had said, there must be other ways of leaving, of returning. This song lifts you way above the black coat, way above your self-identification of the night, high golden moon, an image. I am flying for your sake. After my injection, like any folk shaman of the path. In the beginning, when young, I tried and failed, and as I suffered more and more, improved. Now, in my defect, I'm best of all. In my earlier injections, I was the twin of this now. I took on the stories I am casting away like old medicines. The songs are inside within small red cells. The stories once coiled into snakes I cut to pieces. They're trembling words which connect vibrationally. His tears are old, and now that they're flames, I can use them. In the dissolution,
of my wrong location, from the dark blue dock of the spine, cast off, shook it, broke it, tears our old spine. It's good that you're trapped in your illness. I'm going to find your soul. I'm going to find your soul. This is the oldest song. My old friend, could I call it that, so fierce? A visage in the orange flash. It eats you because you think that you're people. I have a necklace of bloody teeth for this cure. Teeth of many martyrs. The stars above the barren town move in waves. Crickets sing too. See the empty haunt here. It eats you. But how many of death's teeth have I stolen? It doesn't have any left. Pass through the image of death. He's taken your name. I had no name. Do not remember me, unreal Lord. You are wrong about everything. There's a cure in each instant, if you can keep it from ending. Don't think what the songs think now. I hear her hypnotic voice, the blood on my hair. Soon be over. Sorrow will have an end. No, don't think what the songs think. Just think how they sound. Don't answer, if you can. And he walks with me and he talks with me where the sister dwells with the flame jaguar. Is this the debt to beauty? The whole conception was bloody. Heap of silver and turquoise, my magic. If you change, you show it indifferently. Crickets don't change the federales' ways. Crickets don't even know the federales. Cross the silver mesh path there, turn off the law. I'm not part of your growth chart saying this life is compelled. I have the unconditioned in a heap in my pocket, she says in her bloody monotone. Where is the change? It's in you. It's my magic. No one's. I'm waiting in shallow water. Wade in the water. Lift your skirt. I've done this so many times. How did you learn it? It's in my genes. It's in my global genes. There were once jaguars everywhere around here. There will be animals in your deaths, won't there? I'm talking directly to you. I'll greet my defect, my soul, with this animal part of the folk. If I find your soul, do you want it? I see it everywhere, past the death visage. If I find your soul, do you want it? Do you even know? Do you even know what part of you you are? Big medallion, the gold you invested, a precision of sorrow, cut out to be a face you'll almost remember. It floats within. On the road of the souls, the jaguar and I. Through the deserts of dying words and spirits thick as bats flow, plow on through Corolla Pass to meet my love. See the souls around me everywhere, one of them is you. I know who I was, says the soul, I don't try to remember it. It's the promised line, not the promised land, what you recall, that's all. He has a big face, his eyes are closed, I wouldn't want to go back, he says. I don't blame you. What will you return with, then? A fair deal, I say. When I died, he says, everything was unresolved. That's always the case with deaths. There is no official cause of death, is there? Yes, there is, but it isn't correct. I had what you have now, he says. That's not why I came, or is it part? I should bring back a soul. It's my work, after all. Shades crowding around the bloody jaguar. Shades crowding around my blood-red hair. Then I see her. Young, eyes closed, I see my own soul. How do you know? It stands between the king and queen of swords. There are no rooms here, there are no beds. Where is there rest, I ask. That's not the right language, he says. There's plenty of rest here, as I once told you there'd be. She's resting, you know. She needed some peace, he says. I see my own soul there, heavily guarded. By others, as always. This is an ancient procedure. I know that she doesn't want to die, though her land is condemned. My own soul doesn't want to die. The hoot owl sings, the jaguar grins. I'm taking her back, I say, and I reach for her hand and lead her from between the king and queen. Then I face my old love, no one. I gave you the illness, he says. It doesn't matter, love, I say, lady. Mm-hmm.
downloading this Scottish Poetry Library podcast. For further information about the Scottish Poetry Library, visit our website at www.scottishpoetrylibrary.org.uk, follow us on Twitter at By Leaves We Live, and find us on Facebook. I did the same, I didn't bring gravy.